My guest is Nick Clegg. Nick Clegg was the UK's Deputy Prime Minister from 2010 to 2015 in the UK's first coalition government in more than 70 years. He had been leader of the Liberal Democrat Party since 2007. Before his career in British politics, he worked in the European Commission in Brussels and was a member of the European Parliament. In 2018, he became President of Global Affairs at Meta, the former Facebook, a post he left earlier this year. He is the author of a new book, How to Save the Internet: The Threat to Global Connection in the Age of AI and Political Conflict. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
It's very good to see you again, Paul.
Nice to see you. Right, let's get cracking. I'm going to start with something which seems to me like a paradox, because the tone of your book is actually, in many ways, I wouldn't say downbeat, but quite critical about how the world is shaping up, not just on geopolitical conflict terms, but also the role of technology. And yet you are resolutely upbeat and optimistic, which may seem a bit of a paradox. But for example, I'll start with this quote, your words back at you. Nation states are plowing their own furrows. The global internet is splintering international and regional silos. In fact, the global internet, in its truest sense, no longer exists. So is it too late to do anything about it, Nick?
I think it's true to say that the global internet doesn't actually exist. You could argue it never really existed because you have a Chinese internet, which is based on a wholly different set of values, and is hermetically sealed, almost hermetically sealed off from the rest of the world. And you have an increasing tendency amongst some autocratic or authoritarian or semi-authoritarian jurisdictions to follow suit. So I think you've got a world in which you have a Chinese internet, non-Chinese internet, based broadly on American technologies and American values, but you are going to see, in effect, a Russian internet. You're seeing in other parts of the world jurisdictions seeking to intervene ever more forcefully in the way in which the internet plays out in their territory. So I think it's fair to say that the words global internet were always a bit of a misnomer because we've always had a fractured internet. But the theme that runs through my book is that the trends which lead to ever greater splintering of the internet, of the online world, are accelerating very fast. And one of my motivations for writing the book was that my close to 7 years of working on these issues in Silicon Valley suggested to me that the move towards a splinter net are happening perhaps in a more profound way than many people appreciate. And it's my view that the internet as we know it in Europe, North America, and so on was almost built by accident. And I describe the history right back to sort of DARPA and the early days of Silicon Valley as an almost accidental, organic process of which technological innovations were built up layer upon layer, and the standards and the licensing arrangements and so on to make them interoperable were put in place bit by bit. It was never done according to some grand design, but I think in order to save the openness of the internet, some greater act of political will be required, particularly amongst the techno democracies, the biggest techno democracies in the world, namely the United States, India, and Europe.
Right. And again, one of the themes in your book throughout is that, yes, governments have to change their tune, have to be more aware of what's going on. Industry, the tech sector, obviously has to change its tune or adapt its behavior. And also society, the citizens also need to be more aware of what's going on. Again, back to this optimism point, how confident are you that these prises de conscience, as the French would say, are likely to take place, or are people not too set in their ways?
Well, I think it's very difficult to point to any evidence that is likely to happen anytime soon, certainly under the Trump administration, because as ever with any major global or multilateral issues related to our digital world, American leadership is pretty crucial. And at the moment, the US administration, with the sort of active support and connivance of Silicon Valley, far from wanting to reach out in a spirit of partnership with others to set new rules of the road by which particularly the emerging AI technologies can develop, is going in a almost opposite direction and is rather belligerently hoping to, clobber everybody into submission and to particularly beat China in the race for AI supremacy by asserting a very aggressive America first approach to things. I'm pretty sure that the current strategy is not going to work. I just don't think that the race between China and America when it comes to AI, it's not like outspending the Soviets. There isn't going to be a sort of Berlin Wall moment where suddenly someone in Silicon Valley says, "Eureka, I've invented super intelligence and we've got the keys to the future and we can dictate terms to everybody else." I think it's much more dispersed than that. It already is much more dispersed. I mean, China, here's the great irony, as the world's leading autocracy, is actually spreading or is promoting the democratization of this technology more forcefully than anybody else by open sourcing very versatile new models. So I guess I have sort of short-term pessimism in answer to your question that prise de conscience is going to occur, but I'm pretty sure in the medium to long term it will have to occur if we are going to avoid the ever more dysfunctional fragmentation of the internet. And that will, of course, at some point require a change of heart in DC and, dare I say it, in Silicon Valley as well. And I kind of suspect that's only going to happen through force of circumstance rather than choice. I think it hasn't yet seeped into the body politic in the new US administration that their current approach vis-a-vis China is just not going to guarantee them victory. And at that point, maybe a future US administration will rediscover the art of statecraft and partnership, which will be necessary for America to defend and promote its own interests.
I'm assuming you push back if you don't agree that you are mindful when writing this book that you would be open to the accusation that you were being too sympathetic to the tech industry, to the tech sector, and therefore that you had to make sure that you were suitably critical of the tech sector. You say to save the internet, the open internet, big tech itself is going to have to become a lot more open. And you just use the word connivance in terms of cooperation between the big tech leadership and the White House. To what extent do you think your former colleagues in Silicon Valley are aware that they have to change their behavior? And to what extent do you feel that they feel it is necessary, or this common view, as you know better than I do, that the big tech thinks it's rather doesn't need to have any kind of rules or regulation. It is above the law, as it were.
So, look, first things first, to the first part of your question, I think it's inevitable that, particularly for people, and there are a lot of people about who believe this, who believe that, the American big tech sector is a sort of malign force in the world, that the online world is only full of perils, not opportunities, that AI is a threat rather than in any way a kind of good thing for the world. I mean, if you, and it's, of course, it's very fashionable and has been for some time, and I can understand why people feel this to be very negative, if not outright antagonistic, towards the technology sector as a whole and Silicon Valley in particular. Clearly, if that is your view, I don't think you're going to find my book wholly satisfactory because, I mean, and there are countless books which fill the bookshelves which make that case. And there are articles aplenty in newspapers almost every day of the week that make the case that somehow we should turn the clock back and wave a magic wand and wish big tech away. That's not, I mean, my book, I'm afraid, deals with the complexity and nuance of the way that the world is, rather than just adding to the pile of polemic that is aimed at technology. And I mean, it's hardly unsurprising that, I mean, if I felt that the technology sector was as evil as some people like to assert it is, I wouldn't have worked there in the first place. So of course I'm never gonna scratch that itch for people. And of course I get plenty of brickbats for saying anything of any nuanced value about technology. And I've already received, well, they're not even reviews, they're just sort of rants in certain newspapers just because they don't like the fact that I take a more nuanced approach to these things. But honestly, if I'd written Twelfth Night, they probably would have taken one look at the book and said it was crap. So I can't help that. And honestly, this book is really, I hope, is more for people who have got a somewhat more open mind about things. But to your second part of your question, I can't really answer that. I haven't been in Silicon Valley for quite a while now, not really since the beginning of the year. And I don't sort of talk to them day in, day out in the way that I used to. My sense, but this is my sense, is that there's been such a sort of whiplash in the way in which the whole of Silicon Valley, it's not just Mark Zuckerberg, but Tim Cook and Satya Nadella and Sundar Pichai, all of them, many of them, by the way, lifelong progressive Democrats, some of them at least, have so dramatically switched their approach to dealing with the US administration. They've now really just decided to go all in with all the kind of flattery on display and so on, because that seems to be the modus operandi that the Trump administration or the Trump II administration has imposed upon many leading industries in the United States. I should think for the many of them, it's just a sort of tactic which they feel they have to embark upon in order to retain the space in US society to continue to innovate and to continue to develop and sell their products and so on. Do I think it's a long-term strategy that is sustainable? No, not remotely. For I hope flamingly obvious reason. I mean, firstly, one thing that I know as an ex-politician and as a close observer of politics is that the pendulum always swings. It never gets stuck. And for every action, there's always a reaction. It's the golden rule of politics. And of course, there's going to be a reaction to what's going on at the moment, particularly if ordinary Americans don't feel that their economic fortunes are doing well out of the current eccentric and erratic approach to policymaking from the Trump administration. And secondly, as I said earlier, because I don't think for these global companies, I mean, they may spend all their time worrying about what's going on in DC, but they are, many of them, just quintessentially global companies. Meta, which I of course know best, they worked there for some time. I think I need to look up the stats. I think well over 90% of the users of Meta's apps and services are located outside the United States. Well, in the long run, you can't run a company exclusively adhering to the here today, gone tomorrow biases of one somewhat eccentric administration and hope to plot a stable course across the world, particularly if that administration is, as it is currently doing, being quite as belligerent and offensive to so many of its partners around the world, imposing sky-high tariffs on Vietnam, belittling the Europeans. I mean, this spectacular own goal, which the Trump administration has engineered by basically almost chasing Modi, the leader of the world's largest democracy, into the hands of America's erstwhile rival, Xi Jinping, that just shows how wholly incompetent they are in what they're doing. So I don't think hitching a ride, as these companies have done, with the wagon of state as it is currently organized in DC makes much long-term sense, but I guess they view it as a short-term necessity, is my guess.
Well, it certainly smacks of opportunism, but it also maybe makes your argument that
It smacks of transactionalism, and I think Europeans can get all a bit sniffy and sort of iffy about that. But they're business people, they're business people who are all ferociously competitive with each other. American politics and American business, as you know, is a highly, highly transactional. It's an unsentimental transactional business, and I guess they've all decided that they are useful to each other for now.
But it's important in the context of one of the themes of your book, because you say throughout the book things like we need to build bridges between technology and politics. You say we need a new relationship between big tech and nation states in order to ensure workable guardrails are built around new technologies without killing the golden goose that has brought so much prosperity and opportunity to our societies. In other words, my point is, if these bridges and new relationships are to be built as you recommend, the current behavior of the big tech bros is not particularly conducive to that.
Well, it's conducive to, from their point of view, getting the American government on side, which from their point of view is American companies located in America and, with the bulk of their workforce in the US and so on, is of greatest importance to them. I mean, since obviously you are perhaps more than anybody else a sort of veteran observer of EU affairs, it is interesting to note, and Mark Zuckerberg and others have been very public about this, that it's hardly a secret. It's an assertion hiding in plain sight that one of the motives appears to be that they believe that in pursuing the sort of strategy they currently have embarked upon, that they will be able to garner support from the US administration in seeking to thwart what they view as onerous and excessive or unjustified regulatory intrusions in their business by regulators, most especially in Brussels, not just in Brussels, but also in Delhi and other, and in Brasilia. I mean, the fight versus the Brazilian judiciary is almost more vicious than the pontification that you hear from senior members of the Trump administration about the Brussels bureaucrats. It's very much part of a pushback in both American politics at the moment and American industry against foreign regulators clipping the wings, as they see it, unnecessarily of their businesses. To my mind, I have to say the whole thing is just dripping with hypocrisy because, particularly when you look at the US and EU economic relationship, the US runs a very, significant trade deficit with the EU in goods. They import lots of German cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they have acted very forcefully to try and rebalance that by, in effect, imposing these new tariffs, which are, I mean, they're taxes on the border on EU products making their way across the Atlantic into the US. But the EU runs a massive deficit in services with the US banks, tech, you name it. And the moment the EU does anything to, in any way, affect that flow of trade, the Americans go nuts. Well, you can't have it both ways. You can't say a deficit in goods is some reprehensible thing that needs to be corrected, and then say it's verboten for the Europeans to take any action when they themselves, the Europeans, that is, are laboring under this huge services deficit. So it's as ever at the moment in DC. It's this totally one-eyed view of the world. It's America to the exclusion of everything else, and it's goods to the exclusion of services. And they don't seem to make these connections. Over time, of course, economic reality will reassert itself.
Well, let's bring it back to your book a bit, if I may, Nick. So the role of AI in the future health and direction of the internet, maybe explain. You spend quite a lot of time in the book talking about the potential for AI, and I think it's fair to say you come out as, on balance, very pro. You're in that camp. On balance, AI is a force for good. But could you explain a bit, for the benefit of our listeners, why you think AI will play such an important role in the future of the internet?
I think it's first important to emphasize what I don't think it is. If I thought it was going to snuff out humanity by next Tuesday, if I thought superintelligence was going to emerge overnight and suddenly, what it is to be a human being was going to be basically expunged, which is, I'm only sort of exaggerating for slightly facetious effect. But if you listen to the almost torrent of, as I say, books and articles and the commentariat around this, there is a very strong, line of thought. And by the way, by very, very accomplished people. There are people who've been in this industry for a long time who are very terrified of the very technology that they've been working on. Now, look, of course, when you're talking about making predictions about the future, one needs to be very mindful that your own prediction may be wrong. But from everything I've seen, I just don't yet. Maybe this technology will mutate into something wholly different to what it is now. I just don't see how you get from where we are now to where they predict apocalyptically we might end up in the future. Partly because here's the interesting thing, Paul. We call it artificial intelligence, but maybe it's just human nature. But we spend all our time anthropomorphizing it and imbuing it with human or indeed superhuman qualities. They're machines. They're probabilistic machines. They're very, very sophisticated. They're very versatile. And I'll come to in a minute. It will have a, of course, already is having a disruptive effect, could have a very beneficial effect. But of course, I wouldn't advocate for the deployment of AI in our schools, hospitals, workplaces, if I thought that was a sort of Trojan horse to end civilization as we knew it. So I kind of just don't buy a lot of the kind of apocalyptic stuff. And so I'm not at all naive or utopian about this. I mean, all technologies, needless to say, it's the old-fashioned way of putting this, all technologies can be often used for good or bad. A car is a great way to transport yourself from A to B. It can be turned into a devastating murder weapon as well if you drive into a crowd of people, and so on and so forth. And I definitely think, and I hope you've felt I spelt this out fairly in the book. I think there's some real issues, particularly around the way in which AI, agentic AI as it's called, where will become an increasingly personalized experience for people. And I do worry tremendously about what that means for how kids use AI in the future, how vulnerable adults use AI in the future. But on the whole, I regard this as a very significant evolution, but not as significant as fire or the wheel or possibly even not as significant as the internet itself. I think it is an extremely powerful evolution of a technology which has been around for quite a while. AI has been talked about since the 1950s. I think it's going to have tremendously positive applications in everything from medical diagnostics to meteorological work and climate change mitigation through to how you personalize the education of our kids. It's clearly going to be disruptive in some, and particularly in some workplaces. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sort of frothy and naive about this. I don't think it's good in all circumstances. I think that's the interesting thing about the interaction between society and technology and government and technology is you want to amplify the good and minimize, you probably can never eliminate the bad. And I think we can do this in AI. We've done it before. We can do it again. I worry. I just final thing I'd say on this, Paul. There are two sets of people who, the more I listened to them when I was in Silicon Valley, the more I chose to basically ignore what they said about future technologies. It's the most ardent advocates of technology and the most ardent critics of technology, because they both, from completely opposite directions,
Overstate, maybe.
yeah, they oddly enough do the same thing. They both overstate how helpless we are in front of technology or new technology. And I think we have much more agency than that whole narrative, either almost hysterically negative or hysterically positive, suggests.
But you do quote the head of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, in the book by saying, quote, "In most scenarios, AI will likely worsen overall inequality," end of quote. Do you have any sympathy with that quote since you actually include it in the book?
I do. I think I then quote very quickly after that a whole bunch of rival quotes that say exactly the opposite. And that's part of the problem with this debate. Well, this debate generally, but certainly this debate in terms of the effect of generative AI on the labor market. It really honestly is people just licking their finger and sticking it up in the air and say, oh, you know, and then they come up with these speciously precise things of, you know, 36.97% of the labor force will be disrupted by 2029. No one really knows. My intuition is, having looked at a lot of the rival claims and counterclaims, is a lot of it will depend not on the technology itself, but the pace by which it is adopted. It's not as if we haven't had huge ructions in societies before, as mechanization, whether it's the huge movement of people from the countryside, from, you know, agricultural or indeed subsistence activity through to the cities and to you know, urbanized places of work, or of course the mechanization of industrial output. I think we've done that before, and it has certainly, it doesn't mean that it hasn't been disruptive. It's often accompanied by great social and political dislocation. But I think where it's most disruptive and most unsettling for the for all of us, for society, is if it happens very rapidly. And again, I wouldn't take people from Silicon Valley as the best guide on that, because what they tend to do, certainly what I found when I was there, is they kind of assume that because they've invented a technology, everyone's going to use it by the next day. But again, and I describe this in the book, if you look at how long, I mean, look at desktop computing. Desktop computers were around, I mean, it took about 20 years for them to really, for the desktop computing revolution to be felt fully in the workplace. I just have a hunch that maybe, and there's some early, there was an interesting MIT survey came out about, what, 3 or 4 weeks ago, suggesting that the companies that have been using AI actually have been rolled out more slowly than people predicted, and the benefits have been much more meager. I wonder whether actually it might just take a bit longer for it really to be felt in everyday workplaces than people currently believe.
Right, we're running out of time, Nick, but I want to finish off by talking briefly about Brussels, the EU institutions, the Brussels effect, regulation of tech. You referred earlier to the fact that industry generally, and tech in particular, doesn't like regulation. Fair enough, that's a bit simplistic way of expressing it. But they may have some allies in the unlikely former people like Mario Draghi or even Enrico Letta, right? The authors of these major reports on competitive Europe, basically, to use some shorthand language. To what extent do you think the, drawing your experiences in the European Commission and the cabinet of a commissioner and an MEP, as well as other career highlights, that the EU is now quite dramatically changing its tone and shift, having been this quote unquote regulatory power in the world, to something a bit more humble almost, but that they need to redirect how they expend their energies?
Well, you said about expending their energies. I mean, I think the way that energy has been expended over the last 5, 10 years in Brussels by, everyone from Thierry Breton to many other people who've been working on the last sort of jumbo wave of EU regulation will go down in the history of the EU as one of the most self-harming and catastrophic misallocations of political capital and energy that has possibly happened since the very foundation of the European community. I think it is just astonishing how self-harming EU behaviour has been in this realm. Because,
You mean tech regulation, broadly speaking?
no, what I mean is this very specifically: the fundamental insight from the 1950s onwards about European integration was that we in Europe, this patchwork of different small and medium-sized countries living cheek by jowl, in this dangerous part of the world where we drenched ourselves in blood twice in a matter of a few decades in the last century and so on, that the only way that we could stand tall and deliver the security and prosperity to our citizens and to future generations was to become the sum of our parts. I mean, that is literally the essence of it, that we can do more together than we can apart. And yet, when it came to regulating for digital goods and services, you've had this extraordinary spectacle of commissioners and MEPs and others getting up on their hind legs year after year after year, expending all their energy, to use your phrase, to beat up on American technology without asking themselves what they could do to help European technology. So we've now come up with almost grotesque spectacle of huge new pieces of legislation shoved onto the statute book to clip the wings of American big tech, and absolutely nothing done, which is Draghi and Letta's point correctly, to actually create the economies of scale, the single market, the digital single market that you need in Europe for us to actually flourish and compete with the Chinese and the Americans. Do you know, just to give you by way of an example, do you know that you now have 27 different data protection authorities across the EU, and within Germany, you have 17 different data protection authorities, and they're all interpreting a pre-AI law, GDPR, in slightly different ways, and all trying to apply it in different ways, not only between different countries, but within one country itself? It's madness. And so, is it any wonder that the upshot of all of this is that Europe is now rapidly assuming a sort of museum status in the digital economy compared to China and America? Because if you are a good or smart tech entrepreneur in Lisbon or Helsinki or Vilnius or Prague or Brussels, and you've got a great idea, you can't do what your Chinese and American competitors can do, which is you come up with an idea and then you can immediately make that available to 400, 500, well, many more than that, sort of in China's case, to hundreds of millions of consumers. Instead, you have to run the whole gamut again of national and subnational licensing, IP, and data protection requirements. And meanwhile, people sit in Brussels feeling terribly proud of themselves that they're giving Google and Meta and Apple a hard time. It's fine, give me, but what catastrophic lack of political leadership. A succession of people, and I really, really do think the last European Commission really was a criminal waste of a half a decade, thought it was more fun to issue thunderous press releases threatening Silicon Valley with this, that, and the other, rather than actually ensuring that we can create our own Silicon Valley on this side of the Atlantic. And I think until decision makers in all the EU institutions fully digest what a terrible missed opportunity this has been, and that they should expend, to your point, I love your phrase, expend their energies. Because guess what? In politics and in Brussels, as much as anywhere else, there are only so many hours in the day, there are only so many things you can get done. Put the digital single market, which is a fiction, it is a lie, it does not exist. They talk about it. We have a single market in steel, in coal, in agricultural products. We don't have a digital single market at scale in the thing which actually produces high-value jobs for our kids and grandkids. And I sound so frustrated because, as a European, I mean, I remember having a private meeting with Thierry Breton, and I said as diplomatically as I could at one point, I was obviously speaking to him on behalf of Meta. I said, look, I remember saying to him, I'm not saying this on behalf of Meta, but I really do think the lack of a scale digital single market, it's a real failing. And he beat the table and he said, how dare you say this? He went all red-faced. I mean, it's kind of like, it was so odd. It's this sort of weird displacement activity that it was more fashionable for legions of politicians and decision makers in the EU to garner headlines saying they're being tough on American tech rather than doing more, which is their job. That's their job, to help European develop its own big tech.
Right. Well, before you potentially become red-faced yourself, Nick, I think we have to leave it there. Nick Clegg, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.